I'm very happy now to welcome Ali Abu Nima. He is author of the book One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse, and he's co-founder of the Electronic Intifada website, which is electronicintifada.net, and he will be here in Santa Fe giving a talk titled Palestine-Israel, Is a Just Solution Possible? On Saturday, November 6th at 7 o'clock at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Santa Fe, presented by Another Jewish Voice. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, and I'm very much looking forward to my first visit ever to Santa Fe.
We're looking forward to having you. Now, in your book, you paint a picture of your family's life in Palestine before 1948, in which Palestinians and Jews, as you tell the story, socialized together. Your family had friendships across religious and cultural boundaries. They lived among each other. Tell us about your family's history.
Yes, it was very important to me to write about those fragments of life that my parents had told me about. Both my parents are Palestinian, born in Palestine. My mother in a small village near Jerusalem, and she and her family were forced to leave in early 1948. And my father in a village near Bethlehem, which is now in the West Bank, which was occupied in 1967. So really, this has been something that's been with us all our lives. And of course, I didn't want to paint a picture that there was perfect harmony and there was no tension, because that wouldn't be true. There was a nationalist conflict that came about when the Zionist movement began to settle in Palestine. But I think the point I wanted to make is that it wasn't inevitable that Palestinians and Israeli Jews should see each other as enemies. It wasn't inevitable then. There were different paths the story could have taken, and I don't think it's inevitable now. And that's really the point that I want to make in the book.
It's kind of a cliche of political discourse that the only possible solution, if there's to be any solution possible at all, is a two-state solution. Why did Palestinians not buy into a two-state solution at the very beginning when it was offered to divide their land in two, half for them and half for the brand new Israel?
Well, I argue that actually the problem is the effort to partition a country that was a whole country, that had a history, that had a society, just to put it in personal terms, and I tell this story in the book, my father was a boy when the UN made its partition recommendation. You have to remember that there was no provision made for the people of Palestine to have any say in their own future. This was to be imposed from the outside. And people were shocked, and they couldn't understand why, the towns and villages that they intermarried with, that they traded with, would now suddenly be in another country. And they feared, and it turned out correctly, that they would be forced to move, that the partition, historically, has always come with ethnic cleansing. We have this myth that you can have, that countries are like pieces of cheese or like pies and you can slice them. But the reality of partition, everywhere where it has been tried, is that it resulted in enormous ethnic cleansing, enormous forced displacement of people, and terrible loss of life. And it didn't solve the conflict. That continued for years and years afterwards. That was the case with the partition of Ireland, the case with the partition of India, with Cyprus, with really any case you want to come to. So Palestine today sits as this odd exception where everywhere else in the world, we've more or less realized that partition doesn't work. And, for example, the United States is, putting all this effort. Just the other day, Hillary Clinton was in Bosnia telling people that, look, you have to get over your differences. You can't partition off different parts of Bosnia. That was the policy in Northern Ireland, that you had to have power sharing among the different groups in Northern Ireland and increasingly integration of Ireland as an island. But we tell the opposite story with Palestine, where for some reason uniquely we want to divide people. And what I argue actually is that an attempt to partition Palestine into two states now would likely be even more bloody and unsustainable than what happened in 1948. And I don't think it's going to happen. We can see on the ground that things are actually moving in the other direction. So it's really a question of recognizing the reality of all the human beings there and finding a way for us to accommodate the political system to the people rather than trying to shift the people around like pieces on a chessboard to meet one or another political agenda.
So you talk about, instead of this two-state solution with the attendant problems that you just went through, a multicultural model, a one-state model in which Palestinians and Israelis live side by side with the same rights and a secular government. And, of course, many Jews feel that this would destroy Israel, which would no longer be a Jewish state, and they wouldn't have the demographic majority in the long term. How do you respond to those arguments?
Well, the only things, I mean, this one-state solution I'm talking about is already there in certain respects and not in others. So let's be clear what's there and what isn't. There is already a slim, likely Palestinian majority. The numbers are very close within historic Palestine or Greater Israel, whatever you want to call it. So right now, under the authority of the Israeli government, in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and within Israel, there is a Palestinian majority. Or let's just say, for the sake of argument, it's 50%. And let's not kid ourselves. The whole country is under Israeli control. I mean, even in Gaza, you know, the amount of potato chips and soda that comes in and out is controlled by the Israeli government. In the West Bank, the situation is the same. So the myth of a Palestinian authority and a Palestinian government is very much for show, just like the Bantustan government in South Africa. The only government that is really in control is the Israeli government, and it's a minority government. It's a government by, of, and for half the people. So Israeli Jews don't get to choose the demographics. The demographics are a given. The second thing is, are the populations separable? Well, you know, you already have 1.5 million Palestinians living in Israel as citizens, nominally, although second-class citizens. You have 500,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank, and many of them are now second or third generation there. So what are you going to do? Are you going to expel 500,000 settlers? Are you going to expel 1.5 million Palestinians from inside Israel? Or are you going to end up with some kind of apartheid? Those are the choices that we face. So what I'm saying is that we leave people where they are, where they're already living, but you change their relationship to each other. So instead of Israelis being masters and colonizers and occupiers, they become citizens. They become partners in an enterprise where everybody gets to live with equal rights, where those who have been treated unjustly, refugees, landowners whose land has been taken, get justice and restitution. Now, is all this difficult? Of course, it's extremely difficult. I was in South Africa a few months ago where they've had to do pretty much what I'm describing. And it's terribly difficult. I mean, the legacies of apartheid are very long-lasting and are still there. And in some respects, get worse before they get better. In Northern Ireland, you have a very similar endeavor going on. It's extremely difficult. So I'm not arguing this is easy or that you get to utopia in one step. But what I'm saying is there's a huge space between what's very difficult and what's impossible. And that's where hope lives, between what's very difficult and what's impossible. So, yes, it's possible. Yes, Israeli Jews will be afraid of the change because they'll feel that they're losing power. But apartheid and maintaining control of a Palestinian majority by force in perpetuity is not an option either. So this change will have to come.
We're talking to journalist Ali Abunima. And one of the things that I was thinking about as I was reading your book and thinking about other places, including borderlands here in the United States, between the United States and Mexico, the media love to construct enmities. And in fact, in a lot of border areas, even where there's a power differential, there's a lot of sharing going on, cultural sharing, interpersonal sharing, and so on. What does that look like in Palestine and Israel?
Well, it's such a good analogy because I visited the border areas a couple of times. A couple of years ago, I went to Tucson, and I was taken with volunteers with the group No Más Muertes, No More Deaths, to see the border and the border walls that have been constructed along the U.S.-Mexico border. And what's so striking in that case, and is very true in Palestine, I mean, the thing people say is, we didn't cross the border crossed us. And there's so much truth to that, because these constructions, these walls, these demands for more enforcement, for militarization of the border, they cut like a knife into communities, into families, into relationships that have existed across those regions and those areas for generations and for centuries, since before the United States existed. And that's also true in Palestine. So I think it's very important that we recognize what these borders do and recognize that borders are not the same for everyone, but for well-to-do Americans, the Mexican border is invisible. There's no border there. We can go with our passports and go to Tijuana or to Cancun or drive across the border for the day. And that's minor inconvenience. It's not a big deal. We take it for granted, our right to travel to Mexico. For Mexicans, it's a completely different story. Hundreds of people die in the desert every year to cross these borders, to make a living for their families, to do the jobs that Americans won't do for almost any amount of money. And so those borders are lethal to some people. And that's true in Palestine, where for Israelis who are very privileged, the borders are invisible. The settlers can drive wherever they want, more or less. But for Palestinians, it's a matter of life or death trying to cross borders which cut across their own land. So it's a similar story around the world where we see our spaces really being segmented for rich and for poor, for those with rights and those without. And for some people, these boundaries are invisible, and for others, they're a matter of life and death. And that's what we see becoming really systematic in Palestine and in the United States.
Getting back to the point, though, of the sharing and the positive cultural exchange that does go on, do you see that between Israelis and Palestinians?
Well, it does go on, in fact, and it goes on in all kinds of ways. There are positive ways. I mean, within Israel, you have 1.5 million Palestinian citizens. And for the most part, they get on with Israeli Jews, although that's becoming more and more difficult because of the increasing extremism and nationalism among the Israeli population, which increasingly goes towards, calling for them to be expelled and that kind of thing. But yes, it exists. You have mixed neighborhoods. You have, people who work together. And it happens in other ways. So one of the most forms of cooperation that goes on is in criminal rings, that these borders between the West Bank and Israel are very porous for car thieves, that there are sort of car thief rings that work across these borders. And so, it's the tendency of human beings to mix. And that's why states which don't want them to mix have to be so rigorous about trying to enforce laws and regulations that separate them.
I
would also say, if I may, that, sadly, I wish I could say that there was much more of an Israeli movement against these injustices, against the kind of apartheid. Sadly, a lot of the Israeli public is going along with it. But there are Israelis who are there every single day in the West Bank, alongside Palestinians, working to end this and working to create a vision in which people are living together, or at least not fighting with each other. So those Israeli voices, even though they're few, are very important to listen to and to recognize, I think.
The big question, of course, is if there were a one-state solution with half Israelis, half Palestinians, and of course, presumably there are mixed marriages and there are Palestinians who are also Israeli and so on, but what happens to the concept of a Jewish state?
Well, you know, I'll tell you a story. The other day I was in St. Louis, and some very strong supporters, religiously observant Jews, very strong supporters of Israel came to my talk. And they didn't say anything during my talk. And afterwards, they came to talk to me. And they had a very similar question to yours. And we ended up having a very interesting discussion. And I asked them a few questions. I said, you know, you clearly are very religiously observant. You value your way of life as Jews. And you want to bring up your children the way you want to and educate them the way you want to. And you're doing that here in St. Louis, Missouri. They said, yes. I said, well, is Missouri a Jewish state? No. So what precisely does it mean to have a Jewish state? If here in the United States we have the protection and the right to live the way we want to raise our children the way we want to, respecting the rights of others, why would we need to declare the United States to be a Jewish state or a Christian state or a white state or any other kind of state? And exactly the same applies in Palestine. So if the concept of a Jewish state is a state where you have special privileges and special rights because you're a Jew, that's not a concept of a Jewish state that anyone should defend or support. But if you're talking about a country in which there is a large Jewish community that enjoys all the protections of the law, that gets to live the way it wants, like every other community, then that's a very good thing, and that's really what I'm talking about. I oppose any kind of sectarian state, whether it's a Jewish state, a Christian state, a Muslim state, or any other kind of state that privileges one group or another. Because the human reality is we're all different things. And none of us is just one thing. All of us identify ourselves with different communities at different times. And so we have to live in a way that allows everyone to do that.
And I have to say, I mean, there's always challenges to this idea, but that's one of the basic foundations of the United States and that gives us our strength is being a fundamentally secular state.
And, you know, it's under challenge in this country. It's not to be taken for granted because we've seen the rise recently of very scary right-wing forces that do want the United States to be a Christian state, that are out inciting hatred against Muslims, against immigrants, against gay people, and are using this kind of politics of hate and fear to try to scare people into supporting a specific vision of what the United States should look like. So, you know, even in this country where we take for granted the kinds of constitutional protections that people fought for. Remember, people had to fight in this country for women to be able to vote, for African Americans to have full citizenship. All those things we take for granted are not to be taken for granted. But I agree with you. That's the ideal we hold out, even if we don't live up to it. And that's exactly the way I think it should be for Palestinians and Israelis.
The emotional dimension of this factors in, obviously, very strongly, as it does into so many political issues. I've heard people call Israel a state that has post-traumatic stress syndrome. There's prejudice, there's hatred, there's anger. If I were a Palestinian living in Gaza right now, I think I'd be very angry. We've had Mohammed Omer on this show, and I don't know how he and his family survived the things that they've been through. And so a one-state solution, taking into account decades and decades of both oppression and post-trauma and all this, What would a process of healing look like, of reconciliation? What are some models that you hold up for that?
Well, you know, that is going to be difficult. I don't think there are models. You know, to tell you the truth, when I've looked and I've tried to research this, I don't think there's anyone in the world who's discovered the magic formula to make this happen. I think that it happens a little bit differently everywhere, but there are certain things we should try to learn. We should go and look at the experiences in South Africa and Northern Ireland, which are perhaps the closest parallels right now. But, I mean, in this country, have we done a very good job of coming to terms with the legacy of slavery? I'm not sure that all Americans really are still comfortable or have really faced up to the enormity of the consequences of chattel slavery in this country and its lasting legacy. For example, the refusal in this country to have a discussion about reparations shows that we still have terrible taboos or huge taboos which we're unable to deal with. The same goes with the way we relate to the history of genocide against Native people in this country. So have we even done a very good job in this country of reconciling ourselves with the past, or do we just comfort ourselves with an image of a country where, you know, all this stuff is sorted out and left behind? So these are, again, challenges that are not unique to Palestine, Israel. And I think one of the things I always try to stress is that, you know, Palestine is often held out as a sort of a very unique place. And, of course, everywhere in the world is unique in its own way. But so many of the challenges Palestinians and Israelis face of equal rights, of sharing resources, of coming to terms with history, of moving from oppressor and oppressed to equal citizens and partners, are challenges that many people face all over the world. And some people have already gotten further down the path, and so we would do well to go and study with them and learn from them, and to think that we have to reinvent the wheel, all by ourselves.
In the 4 years since your book came out, how has this idea, the idea of a one-state solution, how has it been faring? Has it grown since you published the book?
Gosh, I think my publisher probably wishes that I'd waited a couple of years, because one of the disadvantages to being very early with an idea is that people aren't ready for it. So one of the amazing experiences is to see that there's actually more interest and discussion about my book now than when it first came out a few years ago. And I think that's because a lot of the things I said in the book are really coming to bear fruit, that the kinds of patterns and shifts that I saw in the book have happened. And one of the things that I really saw a few years ago was that we would get to a point within a relatively short time where there would be widespread recognition that the two-state solution is over, that it's a fantasy. And then there would be, first of all, kind of a collective denial. And then once people begin to recognize that reality, they're going to say, now what? And I think we're starting to get to the now what. Is there an alternative? And that's why I felt it was so important to write the book and to begin the discussion, to try to get a head start on what it looks like. And so I've been spending the past couple of years trying to learn as much as I can about Northern Ireland, about South Africa, to begin to understand what this can look like, how these transformations can start to happen. Of course, we all know no situation is identical to another. You have to take everything on its own terms. But there's a lot we can learn, and the sooner we get our heads around it, the less painful it's going to be.
Ali Abunima is the author of One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestine Impasse, which is available at the Santa Fe Library, among other places. And he's co-founder of the Electronic Intifada, which is a website. It's at electronicintifada.net. And he will be giving a talk titled Palestine, Israel, Is a Just Solution Possible? On Saturday, the 6th of November at 7 o'clock at the Unitarian Congregation here in Santa Fe, presented by Another Jewish Voice. For more information, you can call 505-466-3184. Ali, thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. I look forward to seeing you on November 6th.
Likewise. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.